Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. Today's guest is Glenn Livingston, PhD, where we talk about food addiction, overeating, and how to never binge again. Glenn is the author of the book with the same name, which has over 12,000 reviews on Amazon UK and even more on Amazon.com. And his book has helped, and his research has helped, support so many people when it comes to helping their overeating, their stress eating, and their binge eating. In today's episode, we talk about Glenn's personal history with his weight and what led him down the path of studying binge eating, the different types of binges based on your cravings, so chocolate binging versus craving salty foods versus other types of cravings, and where some of the reasons and some of the triggers that are potentially conditioning you and the behavior that leads to eating certain foods at certain times. We also talk about practical tips and techniques to hijack your reptilian brain when you get cravings, and Glenn's four categories of rules when it comes to food. So the always category, nevers, conditionals, and unrestricted. So this is a really interesting conversation. Glenn has some approaches that I haven't previously talked about on the podcast that work against some of the techniques that I will generally offer. And I think having different tools in your arsenal and different tools in your toolkit is always very useful. Things like, you know, separating food into good and bad categories, something I'll talk about a lot on the podcast, where Glenn will talk about making rules for yourself on what foods you can always have, what foods you can never have, and the conditions and the unrestricted foods that you apply or use in your everyday life so that you get what food freedom means to you. So very interesting conversation. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I enjoyed recording. So without further ado, here is today's episode with Glenn Livingston on food addiction, overeating, and how to never binge again. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Glenn Livingston, PhD. Dr. Livingston is a veteran psychologist who became disillusioned by what traditional psychology had to offer overweight and or food-obsessed individuals, and spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating via work with his patients and a self-funded research program with more than 40,000 participants. Most important, however, was his own personal journey out of obesity and food prison to a normal, healthy weight and a much more lighthearted relationship with food. He is also the author of the great book, Never Binge Again, which goes through how thousands of people have stopped overeating and binge eating and stuck to their diet of choice by reprogramming themselves to think differently about food. I'm really looking forward to talking all things binge eating in today's show. Glenn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this all week long.
Me too, Glenn. As soon as the guys reached out about coming on the podcast, I was like, yes, lock him in, book him in. I know the book. I'm familiar with the book. I'm familiar with what you've covered in terms of the research on it. And I've been dying to have this conversation because I know how much my audience would benefit from it. But before we start to dive into all things overeating, stress eating, binge eating, etc., talk a little bit about your backstory and what got you interested in binge eating.
I mean, if you've ever been to the Woodbury Country Deli on Long Island and they were out of Pop-Tarts or pizza, the odds are that I was probably there before you. So I'm not just a doctor who decided to work with binge eaters. I'm someone who had a lot of problems for a lot of years. Not really problems in the last 12 or 15 years, but before that. When I was a boy, I'm 6'4". I'm modestly muscular without doing anything to maintain it. When I did work out for a couple hours a day, I discovered I could eat whatever I wanted to. So, you know, boxes of pizza, boxes of donuts, 6 to 12 chocolate bars, whatever wasn't nailed down, I could eat. And I thought it was really great. I didn't think it was a problem. I was thin, I was handsome, I was athletic, and I was enjoying myself. I didn't think it was a problem. But what happened was I got a little older, and I got married at 22 years old, and I decided to go to graduate school, and I would commute for 2 hours each way to see patients and go to classes, and then I would get home, and God forbid my ex-wife, but, you know, wife at the time, wanted to talk to me, And I just didn't have time to work out, like maybe a half hour a week, not 2 hours a day. And I was a little older, so my metabolism slowed down, but I couldn't stop thinking about food. I felt like it had a life of its own. And I'd be sitting and working with a suicidal patient or a couple in crisis. And if you know anything about psychology, you know it's not really an intellectual endeavor. I mean, it is. You got to know a lot of stuff. But really, you have to lend people your soul so that they love and trust you enough to think new thoughts and leave their comfort zone. And it's always been exceptionally important to me to be a great psychologist. Not only were my father and mother psychotherapists, but everyone in the family. There are literally 17 people in the extended family that are therapists. And something breaks in the house and we all know how to ask it how it feels and nobody knows how to fix it. So, but it's just really important to meet a great psychologist. So that bothered me more than the weight that I was gaining. And I was gaining weight. And coming from the family that I came from, I decided that there must be a psychological solution. So I figured I must have a hole in my heart or I'd have to nurture my inner wounded child to get thin. And I went the psychological route. I saw all the best psychologists and psychiatrists. I took medication. I went to Overeaters Anonymous. I did all these spiritual pursuits. And, you know, things would get better for a little while and then they would get a lot worse. And I just couldn't figure out what was going on. And this actually went on for, oh gosh, until I was in my early 40s. And I was, you know, fatter at some times and a little thinner at other times. But basically, it was a steady stair step and an upward climb until I was around probably 280 pounds. My triglycerides were over 1,000. And the doctors were telling me I was going to die soon if I didn't stop this. And I just felt like I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. And I was embarrassed in front of my patients. And it was awful. It was awful. Along the way, I also wound up doing a lot of corporate consulting. So in addition to my clinical practice, which was child and family, I also wound up consulting for big food and big pharma because my ex was doing that on a qualitative level and I was doing it on a quantitative level, you know, because she traveled a lot and I didn't commute and we didn't have kids. So I had a lot of time. So I developed a second career doing all this consulting. And what I saw in the advertising industry and what I saw in the food industry frightened me and made me think that maybe loving yourself thin isn't the right paradigm. Maybe food addiction isn't really the result of childhood trauma and having a hole in your heart, but maybe there was something else going on. Because what I saw was that these big food companies were spending millions, if not billions of dollars to engineer these hyper-palatable food-like substances, like concentrations of starch and sugar and fat and excitotoxins and salt. And it was all designed to hit the bliss point in the reptilian brain, you know, the seat of the feast and famine response, without giving you enough nutrition to feel satisfied. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to bypass the natural pleasure system in the brain and hit those buttons in a way that evolution never prepared us for. And what happens when you do that, if you look at the animal studies, is that the survival drive is hijacked. There are all these studies starting with rats where they put electrodes in the pleasure center and they allowed those rats to self-stimulate, to press a lever and self-stimulate. And they found that those rats would ignore their survival needs to press that lever thousands of times per day. You know, a starving rat would ignore food to press the lever thousands of times per day. A nursing mother rat would ignore her pups to press the lever. Rats would climb over painful electrical grids to press the lever. So when you overstimulate the pleasure centers, mammals will forget about their survival needs. And they replicated this in higher mammals and I think even humans. I'm not saying that anybody's putting electrodes in our brain. But I think when you can walk out of a McDonald's and see a Burger King across the street, that it's not a far stretch to say there are some chemical electrodes being stimulating our brains. So I saw that was happening in the food substances they were engineering. And then in the advertising industry, they were doing things to fool us into thinking these were healthy things for our bodies. So for example, I work with this major food bar manufacturer, very, very big company, very profitable. And the VP of the company, who happened to be a friend of mine from high school, he pulled me aside as he was leaving the company and said, I have to tell you what our most profitable insight was. And he was kind of hanging his head in shame. And this was part of why he was leaving. He said, Glenn, we took the vitamins out of the bar. They were too expensive and they were making it taste bad. And we put the money into the packaging instead. So we made it look bright and shiny and multicolored. And we essentially fooled people's brain into thinking this was a big salad. Because if you think about where you find a diversity of bright colors in nature, you know, they tell you to eat the rainbow. So you've got a salad with dark green lettuce and bright red tomatoes and, you know, yellow carrots and red and blueberries and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's good advice to eat the rainbow because you get a diversity of micronutrients. And they were taking advantage of that element of the brain, you know, that evolution put there for a reason to fool us into thinking there was nutrition there, but the nutrition really wasn't there. And that goes on across the industry. That's not just a foodware manufacturer. That goes on across the industry. And so here are these two really powerful forces that have nothing to do with the fact that my mama didn't love me enough, or I was in a bad marriage, or I was lonely or brokenhearted. They're very powerful forces that are addressing the lizard brain directly, the reptilian brain directly. Then I started looking at the neurology of it all. And this really shocked me. Do you know that the reptilian brain doesn't know love? The reptilian brain looks at something in the environment and it says, do I eat it? Do I mate with it? Or do I kill it? It's the mammalian brain that's on top of that, that's able to impose a delay that says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact will that have on the people that you love or the animals in your tribe? And then it's the neocortex, which is on top of that, that says, before you eat, mate, or kill that thing, what impact is that going to have on the type of person you want to be, or your long-term goals, or your spirituality, or your art, or your music, or, you know, your health and fitness goals. And so here I am spending 20 years trying to love myself thin when the part of the brain that responds to food addiction doesn't know love. And there are all these external forces that are creating this perfect storm for really everybody to eat beyond their own best judgment, because it takes over. So I kind of put that all together, and then I did my own study. So I was getting paid a lot of money to do these big studies for corporations, so I set up my own study, I funded it myself, to intercept people when they were feeling particularly stressed and ask them what foods did they turn to when they're stressed that they can't stop eating. And I found three interesting things. I found that people who struggled with chocolate, and all of my binges always started with chocolate, they tended to be brokenhearted or lonely or depressed. And people who struggled with salty, crunchy things, they tended to be more stressed at work. And people who struggled with soft, chewy, starchy things, they tended to be more stressed at home. And I thought that was really interesting. But this actually turned out to be the thing that convinced me that we don't necessarily eat for emotional reasons. We're eating because the lizard brain is overstimulated. I went to my mom. And before I was going to publish these results, I wanted to find out from a woman who not only raised me but was a therapist, why do I run to chocolate when I'm feeling lonely or brokenhearted? And I get her on a call, and she gets this horrible look on her face, this horrible sound in her voice, and she says, I'm so sorry, Glenn. And I said, Mom, what do you mean? It's okay. It's, you know, 40 years ago. Whatever happened, happened. I forgive you. I love you. I'm just trying to figure this out. And she says, I'm so sorry, but when you were 1 year old in 1965, your dad was a captain in the army, and they were talking about sending him to Vietnam, and I was terrified. We were trying to get pregnant with your sister, and I thought, I'm going to be this, you know, young army widow with no way to make a living and two small kids. And then at the same time, my father, your grandfather, Glenn, he had just gotten out of prison. And I had idolized this man. I had no idea he was guilty, and he was. And so my whole world came crashing down. So when you would come running to me for love or to play or for some healthy food, I just didn't have the wherewithal to make that for you. So what I did instead was I kept a big bottle of chocolate Bosco syrup on the floor. and in a refrigerator on the floor. And when you would come running to me, I'd say, go get your Bosco Glen. And you'd go crawling over to the refrigerator. You'd take out the bottle. You'd open the cap. And you'd suck on it. And you'd go into a chocolate sugar coma. If this were a movie, at that juncture, Mom and I should have a big cry and a big hug. And I should never want to eat chocolate again or overeat anyway. And we did have a hug. And we did, you know, forgive each other. And it was a good conversation to have. My chocolate binges actually got worse. And the reason they got worse, because I found there was this crazy voice in my head. And it went something like this. You know, Glenn, you're right. Our mama didn't love us enough, and she left a great big chocolate-sized hole in your heart. And until you can get out of this marriage and find the love of your life, you're going to have to go right on binging. Let's go get some more chocolate right now. Yippee, let's go do it. And so it used that whole thing as a justification. And so that was actually the turning point for me. When you combined it with what I knew about big food and big advertising and these external forces and the fact that the lizard brain doesn't know love and the fact that even understanding what started, what was the match that lit the fire, even understanding that didn't help me put it out, I started to say to myself, well, what if you don't have to put out the fire? Like if there's a roaring fire in the living room, in a well-contained fireplace, that's an asset, not a liability. That becomes an opportunity for people to gather around and make memories and laugh and cry and hug and tell stories. It's only if there are holes in the fireplace that an ash could escape and burn the house down. And so I started to recognize that it was this crazy voice of justification that was poking holes in the fireplace. I said, well, if you could really fix the fireplace, then you'd actually be severing the link between emotion and overeating. It's not that emotion doesn't make you want to overeat, because we can talk about emotion in detail in a little bit if you want to. But it's that even if emotion made you want to overeat, it couldn't make you overeat if there wasn't this voice of justification in between. And this is when I did something a little crazy. And I was not going to publish this. At the time, I was running a coach training organization. And I was happy with my life and my business. I wasn't super happy with my life, but I was happy with my business. And this was just going to be a private thing I was going to try for myself. And so I decided I was going to draw a very bright line between healthy and unhealthy eating. So, for example, I will never have chocolate on a weekday again. I'll only have chocolate on Saturday or Sunday. And then I decided that my reptilian brain, I needed a way to understand the thoughts it was generating versus the thoughts I was generating. And I decided I was going to call it my inner pig. And if I heard a voice that said, you know what, Glenn, you worked out hard enough, even though it's a Wednesday, you can have some chocolate, you're not going to gain any weight, you can just start again tomorrow, it's just as easy, I would say, wait a minute, that's not me, that's my inner pig. And my inner pig is squealing for pig slop, because chocolate on a Wednesday is pig slop. And I don't need pig slop, and I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And you know, I was already a very sophisticated psychologist with so many publications and recognitions at that point. But what actually got me better was saying, I don't need pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And it wasn't a miracle that cured everything all at once. But what it did was it would wake me up and give me those extra microseconds to make a better decision. And sometimes I wouldn't, sometimes I wouldn't. But I no longer felt confused or despairing or hopeless. I no longer felt like I was powerless or out of control. I was just under the influence of my reptilian brain, and I could make a better decision if I wanted to. And slowly but surely, I would adjust the rules to be things that I wanted to follow. Because I decided that following the rules and being able to stick to my own best thinking about food was more important than how fast I lost weight. So I just, if you'll excuse the word, I think up until that point, I was my pig's B-I-T-C-H. I think, right? And I wanted my pig to be my B-I-T-C-H. And so I played with the rules, and you know, I discovered there were some things I could say I would always do. There's some things I would never do. There's some things that I would do under certain conditions, like, you know, I'll only ever have pretzels again in a Major League Baseball park. But what they all had in common was that there were very clear lines, and I knew when I was, I knew when my pig was talking because it was trying to get me to cross them. And then I would disempower what it said. So I kept a journal for about 8 years. And the pig would say, you know, you can just start again tomorrow. It'll be just as easy. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. That's not actually true. Because the principles in neuroplasticity say that if something fires together, it wires together. So if you hear a little voice in your head that says it's just as easy to start tomorrow, and then you go and eat chocolate, you're actually going to be more likely to say the same thing tomorrow, and you're going to be more likely to eat chocolate tomorrow. So if you're in a hole, you really have to stop digging. And I call that disputing the pig. I call that, you know, looking for the lie in what the pig was telling you. And I found that if I did that, that the pig had a harder time using the same excuse next time. The analogy I would use is, if previously it was like a greased chute, now I could still go down the chute, but it was like going down a chute filled with sandpaper. And I didn't really want to. Or sometimes I wanted to and I tried to do it anyway, but it was very uncomfortable because I eliminated the justification. So I wasn't greasing the chute anymore. And slowly but surely, I got thin over the course of 8 years. I kept a long journal of, you know, dozens of things my pig would say and why it was wrong. And then in 2015, as I was getting divorced, I was a minor partner in a publishing company. And the CEO said to me, Glenn, we need to write a book so we could attract better authors, because our current authors won't let us do the kind of marketing we need to do. We need to prove we know what we're doing. Can you turn that journal into a book? And I spent that summer turning the journal into the book, and I sent it to my CEO. And he came back and said, brilliant, Glenn, I don't eat donuts. Donuts are pig slop. I don't let farm animals tell me what to do. And he proceeded to lose almost 100 pounds. And along the way, we published it, and we took the long road. We did everything right. And now we have 1 million readers and more reviews than the Da Vinci Code. And if I go to a bookstore, people don't quite recognize me by name. But sometimes they'll come up to me and point to me, and they'll go, pig guy. Pig guy. Which is exactly what you want to happen on a first date.
100%. I think I've been called significantly worse. So I know the feeling. I'm very curious, Glenn, because you mentioned there, I said the four categories of rules. So the always, the nevers, the conditionals, the unrestricted. As somebody that has my own personal history of binge eating, slightly different. I wasn't overweight. It was more from, I was a competitive bodybuilder. I would do a lot of stuff as a fitness model, and I would go on massive binge restrict cycles where I would eat super clean for 6, 7, 8 weeks, and then I would just binge on ice cream and chocolate for several weeks after, and I'd look like two different people based on the time of the month that you saw me. Do you find that for people that are in that bracket, that are not necessarily 100 or 200 pounds overweight, that they can benefit, or they from your experience of working with them, would that always, never, conditionals or unrestricted, and how to split those foods into the categories, is that a useful strategy for them, or would you recommend something else for those individuals?
I do work with bodybuilders, and they're a unique crew. Let me lay out what I believe the fundamental cause of binge eating really is, besides the food industry stealing your survival drive and, you know, some fat cat in a white suit and a mustache laughing all the way to the bank every time that you look for love at the bottom of a bag or a box or a container. I believe that there's an evolutionary mechanism in the brain that says that if food is very scarce, food and nutrition are very scarce for a period of time, then the moment that it's available, you need to hoard it. And this is why, by the way, that feeling too full can be a trigger for a lot of binge eaters. Because most people who struggle with overeating on any level are also good dieters. And most people will tell you a story of being able to lose weight or follow any diet for a while, but then they just can't anymore and they're off to the races. And so competitive bodybuilders will go in these 16-week cycles where they're on a very restrictive diet preparing for a contest, but then they have a pizza waiting for them as soon as they get off stage, right?
Or seven.
or seven, yeah. Right. And, you know, there is a diagnosis called exercise bulimia where the exercise is seen as a kind of purging. If people really want to stop that behavior, it's difficult if you're going to continue to compete because you're entering the binge and restrict cycle all the time. And what we try to advise people if they want to stop the binging is to flood their body with nutrition at a small caloric deficit and leave a longer period of time so they can get to where they need to go. So you're looking for a way of life that doesn't really involve having seven pizzas. You're looking for a way of life that keeps you, you know, within striking range of your competitive weight, but you have to leave yourself longer to get there, and you know, your coach might not be happy with that and all that kind of thing. So with competitive bodybuilders, what we do is we try to convince them, you know, to start sooner, and they have two different food plans. They'll make a set of rules for when they're not competing, and they'll make a set of rules for when they're trying to compete. But we try to get them out of the idea that they should, you know, restrict so aggressively. And frankly, sometimes the competitive bodybuilders just don't want to work with us because it's very, very difficult to stop the binge eating if you're going to restrict so significantly for periods of time before that. Because there's you're fighting evolution. You're fighting what your body really wants you to do. Which can be done. I mean, think about people going on hunger strikes. They fight what their body really is meant to do. It's not easy. I'm sorry. I wish I had a really easy solution. It's not easy.
Yeah, there's definitely a massive downregulation in hormones as well. Your ghrelin, your leptin, your hunger, your satiety hormones. That's kind of my area that I would always come at it from. One of the things that really supported me as well, and it falls slightly outside of what you've mentioned there, but it's very much an alternative tool of not splitting foods into good and bad categories. I was really bad for that, you know, and I think that belief system was really helpful for me when I was 5 years old. You know, my daughter 6 years old, I think it's helpful for her to be like, that food is good, that food is bad. But for me, as someone in my early 30s, or you know, a female or male listening to this in their early 30s, mid 30s, late 40s, sometimes splitting and not splitting foods into good and bad categories can be useful. And then other times, making categories of rules, you know, what food can you always have, what food can you never have, what foods can you have under certain conditions, and what foods, you know, are unrestricted. I think it's very much a case of finding what's going to be a good fit for you based on, you know, your circumstance, based on your starting point. I'm curious, Glenn, you mentioned there the crazy voice of justification. I love that language that you use because it talks about kind of your own story and the inner dialogue that's going on in your head. Do you find from your area of expertise that a lot of binge eating, you know, you mentioned chocolate there and you know, your history with, you know, your mum, is it generally deep rooted with people, or is it sometimes just more surface level through bad habits? You know, you've mentioned obviously the food industry evolution. But just from your area of expertise, do you normally find that there's normally some form of deep-rooted, you know, we can label it trauma, or just, you know, not even trauma, but just something that's happened in experience that has led you to react to food this way on top of the things that you've mentioned? Or is it sometimes more surface level? What do you normally see in your area of expertise?
Often, but not always. Often, but not always, there's a deep-rooted trauma that started it. But I do not believe that the initial trauma has to be cured in order to stop the binge eating. And so most people, most psychologists who see the association, believe that they're not going to be able to cure the binge eating until they cure the original trauma. And so they'll have people spend, you know, 5 or 10 years in in-depth psychoanalysis or something like that, or psychotherapy, so they can figure out why they're, you know, mama didn't love them enough and that kind of thing. And that's a very soulful, valuable thing to do. I don't regret the journey that I took looking for all the deep-rooted things. But the question most people don't ask themselves is, if it was a deep-rooted cause, so what? What if the solution was just the same regardless of whether I ever knew what the cause was or not? And because there's so many things that go on physiologically when you stop the binge eating on a practical basis. So first of all, you know, my mama gave me chocolate when she didn't want to feed me, and I was traumatized by that, and I wound up feeling lonely and brokenhearted and running to chocolate instead. And it's all true. It's all true. And knowing that made it possible for me to stop hating myself, to forgive myself, to forgive my mother. It made me a psychologically healthier person to know that. It was a worthwhile endeavor. But I kept binging and binging and binging anyway. But when I instituted a technique which would separate me from the reptilian brain, then I started to recover control without fixing the trauma. I was still in a bad marriage. I was still lonely and brokenhearted. I understood why, but but I was still lonely and brokenhearted. But the ability to jump back up into your upper brain and make intellectual decisions about how to eat was independent of curing the original trauma. There are a couple of other things that are independent of curing the original trauma. So I will tell people to carry around a pad and paper or a smartphone with them so that after they recognize that their pig is squealing to break the line, then they can write down exactly what the pig is saying. And sometimes just the act of writing will give them enough to not follow the craving, because writing is an upper brain activity. Binging is a reptilian brain activity, right? It's an activation of the feast and famine system. Writing is more of an upper brain activity. You can also instruct people, even before they write it down, you can tell them to do what we call as a 7-11 breath, where you breathe in for a count of 7 and you breathe out for a count of 11. And you do that a couple of times. The reason that helps is that it moves you back into the parasympathetic nervous system, or the part of you that wants to engage in resting and digesting. And that's when you can think more rationally and make plans for the future and kind of jump back up into your upper brain. Because, you know, if a tiger was chasing you, you wouldn't have time to breathe out for longer than you were breathing in. So there's some very, very practical things you can do to interfere with the process of binge eating, even though you don't fix the original association. And I found that when you really emphasize those types of practicalities, then people will say, well, then they go back to therapy and the feelings are more prominent because they're not binge eating. And then they can grow through the emotional trauma, you know, with their therapist. But we don't really get into that in our work. We just fix the binge eating. Sometimes it's deep-rooted. More often than not, it is deep-rooted. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's just that people started competitive bodybuilding in their 20s and they started in these, you know, feast and famine cycles, binge and restrict. And then, you know, the lizard brain woke up and discovered that there were these incredible highs available. By the way, people will say they're overeating to escape from trauma or to escape from food, but that ignores the fact that they're not just numbing out, they're actually eating to get high with food, because these, you know, we didn't have chocolate bars in the savannah. We didn't have pizza in the savannah as we were evolving. These are unnatural concentrations of pleasure, which you're entitled to eat if you want to. Like, I'm not saying it's always bad or it's going to keep you out of heaven, but you have to know that part of what you're doing is getting high with food. I find that by switching that paradigm, people are less likely to want to overeat because now they don't think they're just comforting themselves. I also tell people, have you ever gone to the dentist and the dentist was out of Novocaine to numb you out? So he said, that's okay, I'm just going to inject you with Doritos. it just doesn't happen, right? Because you're not really just having the Doritos for their numbing effect. You're having them probably going to get sued now.
Yeah.
You're having them to get
or sponsored by Doritos and all the dentists coming here.
Right.
I think that's so useful and so helpful and so beneficial for people, because what I'm hearing you say, Glenn, is awareness around it is so important. You know, the technique to hijack your reptilian brain and what that would look like, and understanding that there's so many things going on. And I think definitely as somebody who, you know, has been to therapy on different areas and has worked through a lot of kind of journaling myself through other areas of my life, sometimes you don't have to dive head into the trauma in order to get the results and fix the problem. And I think it's very important for people to understand that when it comes to food, because we can definitely be led down the Pandora's box of, you know, you have trauma, you have a traumatic childhood, you know, you can make the justifications and not realize that, well, actually, yes, it can be beneficial to go into that and look into it. And if you need therapy and you need that support, by all means, go for it. But you can also fix your issue by a little bit more practical basis, like you've mentioned. I'm curious there, because you talked about, you know, when I was competing in bodybuilding, and not everyone that listens to this podcast would ever go down that route, but it kind of serves as an idea for what I've experienced. But for me, I used to have triggers, you know, even before I was bodybuilding, I would have to check in with how I'm feeling. Like if I ever got through low spells or felt lonely, or I felt like I wasn't around friends or family, like I would turn to food. Like that was always it was a coping mechanism. mechanism. Now, I had what you talked about earlier where you would exercise through it. So I always balanced out, you know, you're always tipping the scale and balancing it out, but it doesn't make it, you know, any better necessarily. But do you think it's important for people to identify their triggers when it comes to binge eating?
If you were a city traffic planner, you would survey the city and you'd be responsible for optimizing two variables. You'd be optimizing the free flow of traffic so that commerce could take place and people could go see their families. And you'd be optimizing for safety as well. And in order to do that, you'd have to survey every intersection and figure out where the dangerous intersections were so you could put in a traffic light or a stop sign or a yield sign, or some of them nothing at all, right? So like in New York City, they put a stoplight at every corner because there are 11 million people trying to get around, and without those, nobody would get anywhere. There'd be gridlock and accidents and death. So what I tell people, it's like you're designing your own little eco city, and you want to identify your dangerous intersections. You want to maximize your food freedom, you know, because we fought wars in this country to accomplish our freedom or to win our freedom. And I don't want to take any more of that away from you than we have to. But when you found those dangerous intersections, you would put the right level of control in there and you would be alert. So let's say I know that I tend to binge on chocolate. I tend to binge in restaurants, and I have some trouble with family situations. So I would want to write a set of rules that define the role that chocolate would play in my life. I would want to write a set of rules for how I would behave in social situations, and I want to write a set of rules that would define how I behaved in a restaurant. And sometimes that might involve loosening up in the difficult situations. So let's say on an everyday basis, I decided that I don't want to have bread. So I write a rule that says I'll never have bread again. And that's my bullseye. But if you think of an archery target, there are also rungs around the bullseye. So my second rung might be, unless I'm in a restaurant when I may have two slices of bread without butter, right? And so I know that the restaurant situation is difficult, so I've made decisions beforehand. The importance of making your decisions beforehand for your trigger situations is that willpower is the ability to make good decisions. And there's only so much of it we have every day. It's not like a black and white thing. It's more like gas in the tank, and it's worn down by decision making. So if I know that I can have two pieces of bread in a restaurant, then I don't have to deal with the temptation of eating more bread or putting the olive oil on or anything like that. I know exactly what it is. It's a little bit looser than I would aim for when I'm at home. But by having understood that trigger situation, I can plan for and delineate it and eliminate the need for willpower when I'm in that situation. So I think it's very important to identify your triggers and have a plan for how to deal with them. As a matter of fact, my second book was called 45 Binge Trigger Busters, where we talk about very specific binge triggers and how to overcome them. So I guess my short answer is yes, it's important to identify that and plan for them.
And what I'm hearing you say there, which I think is really useful for people, is you have your rules, but the extent in which your rules fall or the length in which they go is very much down to you as a person. You know, like one of my languages that I'll use myself personally and my clients is when you're not splitting those foods into good and bad categories, I'm like, if you want to have a chocolate bar, have a chocolate bar, but don't have 10 of them. You know, if you want to have some ice cream, have a scoop or two, but don't have, you know, the full tub. And you're putting those rules, and they will vary based on your starting point, your history of food for those listening. And it's very much a case of have the rules, because if you don't, it's too easy to fall outside of it. And I think that analogy of the city is so useful. You mentioned there, and what I'm hearing you say, Glenn, over and over again, is there's a lot of self-reflection with this in terms of identifying triggers, in terms of, you know, realizing what's going on in the wider world with the food industry and evolution. And you talked yourself about journaling for 8 years. When it comes to overeating in particular, then, what's a question that you wish people asked more in terms of pulling it back inwards to themselves when it comes to overeating? Because I think when it's binge eating, for me, a helpful one was what was my triggers. And I think you explored that so well for us in terms of a visualization and how that would look. When it comes to overeating in general, then, what's a question that people don't ask themselves enough that would benefit them?
If there were one simple rule that I could make that would make a big difference and give me a lot of bang for the buck, what would that be? Most people, because they're used to the binge and restrict cycle, they set the bar too high for themselves when they want to lose weight. And so they think of themselves as going, quote unquote, on a diet. And you know, we've talked about why that's not usually sustainable. But the people that I've had the most success with, they start with one simple rule. And it's something that they could and would do that would make a big difference, but it's not too burdensome. Like, I knew this truck driver who lost 150 pounds. He used to, I mean, he still does, eat fast food for three meals a day because he's on the road. And he said that his simple rule was that he's just not going to go back for seconds. That's it. He's not going to stop eating fast food. He's going to get all the things that he loves. He's just never going to go back for seconds. And that gave him some momentum. It made him feel like he was able to beat his pig, like he had some control. It gave him some self-esteem. And he did add a couple of rules after that later on. But people start with one simple rule. Sometimes it's just a rule to support mindfulness. Sometimes it's something like, I'll always put my fork down between bites, or I'll always take a picture of my food before I eat it. Just something that inserts a pause and gives people a chance to think about whether they want to do that or not. And then, you know, when you're talking about good food categories and bad food categories, I like people to use a minimum of rules if they can. So that they are able to feel satisfaction with their food overall. However, there are some things where it's easier to have none than some. I've had a lot of clients, and also for me personally with chocolate, I tried 48 ways to Sunday to figure out a rule that would allow me to have a little bit of chocolate, and I just couldn't do it. It didn't matter what I did. So I eventually decided that I just would never have chocolate again, and you know, it's been years. I think it's been like 6 or 7 years now. And I look at a bar of chocolate and I don't understand why I ever wanted it before. It looks like a big bag of chemicals to me. And if I'd known 20 years ago that life was going to be so much easier by just giving it up, I probably would have just given it up then. So I think that people have to be willing to say that sometimes none is easier than some. The biggest deal is one simple rule. That would be the answer to your question, is one simple thing that would be easy for them to do that would make a big difference. Maybe I'll never eat in front of a screen again. Maybe I'll only have pasta on weekends, something like that.
You're preaching to the converted. I literally don't have Ben and Jerry's at all anymore for that exact same reason. I used to get the scoop at the cinema when I'd go to see a movie, and I would go back and I'd miss half the movie because I'd keep going back for more. And then I'd normally pick up a tub on the way home because I'd kind of open those floodgates. So for that particular food, I just don't have any. There's other foods I've got better willpower with. And I think it's so useful for people to identify what that food is and then make the decision. You know, you mentioned there, Glenn, that if you had known that years ago, that you'd look at chocolate now and just see, you know, a bar of chemicals, or completely flipped your mindset on it. Is there anything else that you know now that you wish you had known back then?
When you're aiming for the bullseye, you want to aim with the energy of perfectionism. People are frightened of perfectionism with food because they think that it causes you to binge. But when you're aiming at the bullseye, you need to know exactly where the bullseye starts and ends. It needs to have a boundary. You can't aim at a fuzzy target. And you can utilize, winners use the energy of perfectionism to purge their mind of doubt and insecurity. So an Olympic archer will say, will see the arrow going into the bullseye and become one with the bullseye before they loose the arrow. They're not saying, maybe I'll make it and maybe I won't. And when it comes to a hyper-palatable pleasure, saying, maybe I'll do this and maybe I won't, really just means I'm not going to do this for too long. I'm just going to do it until I don't feel like it anymore, right? So the reason I'll say my book is called Never Binge Again, because it's a lot better title than Binge Sometimes, right?
So true.
however, that doesn't mean that I won't be kind to myself if I made a mistake. So, you know, I intend to never touch a hot stove again. I will never touch a hot stove again. I just won't. But if I do, I'm going to take the time to figure out how that happened so I could avoid it in the future. I'm going to experience the pain because I want it to get my attention. So the analogy would be to be experience a little bit of guilt and shame to get your attention. What I'm not going to do is put my whole hand down on the stove and say, you are a pathetic hot stove tow chair. You might as well just burn your whole hand. I'm not going to allow myself to castigate myself. I'm just going to, if I miss the bullseye, by how much, in what direction, and how do I adjust my sails so that I'm more likely to hit it next time? If I touch the hot stove, why did it happen? How am I going to avoid it next time? And then I'm going to let it go and move on. And it turns out that that negative voice of self-castigation that occurs when you miss the bullseye with food, that says, oh, you're so pathetic, you're never going to get this, you should just give up and be a happy fat person, that voice of castigation is really the reptilian brain trying to get you to feel too weak to resist the next binge. And when you recognize that, it's a piercing insight that allows you to recalibrate yourself and collect evidence of success. Maybe I had 5 cupcakes instead of 15. Maybe I stopped binging after an hour instead of 5 hours. How did I do that? Rather than just saying, why can't I stop eating? Why can't I stop eating? Which encourages you to collect evidence of failure. When you say, why can't I stop eating? Why can't I stop eating? The question itself says, okay, brain, go find evidence that I can't stop eating. And that creates a failure identity as opposed to a success identity when you say, how can I stop eating? What did I do right?
That's super powerful in terms of the identity, the failure identity versus the success identity. I know myself, I've been down this rabbit hole myself and with people I've worked with, that self-castigation where you, or the language you'll use, is that you're a bad person. You know, you'll put your hand on the stove, to keep that analogy, and you're self-castigating yourself for making a mistake. And I think something that helps a lot of people is you see that failure as feedback, like you said, Glenn, that you learn from it. You know, there's just enough pain there that's going to give you feedback on learning going forward, and associating the guilt and the shame with it is something that you're going to have to, you know, journal through or work through with a therapist, or, you know, reading your book and consuming your content and educating yourself around that, I think is really, really important for people to understand. With that in mind, just because I know how many people, as you've said, a million people reading your book, thousands of reviews online, and it's helped so many people over the years. But Glenn, if you had a reach to everybody on the planet who has either suffered or does suffer from overeating or binge eating, either binge restrict cycles like we've talked about, or people who are overweight and struggling with binge eating, if you could figuratively put a message onto, say, Instagram, that you'd hit all of those people on the planet, what would you say to them?
It's much easier than you think to stop. It's not as complicated as most of my colleagues make it out to seem. You don't have to have a spiritual insight. You don't have to contemplate your navel. You don't have to go through 5 years of psychotherapy. Pick a target. Separate the thoughts that suggest you can hit the target from the thoughts that suggest you can't hit the target. Dispute the thoughts that suggest that you can't, and watch yourself build the discipline. You can do it. It's a lot simpler than you think. The other thing I want to tell everybody is, get as much of the processed crap out of your diet as you can. To stop overeating really involves not just installing these Nazi-like police rules, but nourishing your body. When I said, I will never have chocolate except on a Saturday or Sunday, and I would hear my pig squealing on a Wednesday, I didn't just say, well, I'm not going to have the chocolate then. I experimented with different things that would nourish me at those times, because I decided my survival drive was making an error in looking for the chocolate. But what did it really need? And what I discovered was that in the case of chocolate, I usually needed some energy, which I could get from fruit or chlorophyll, maybe some minerals, which I could get from kale juice or celery juice. And I started making these different types of smoothies, and banana, kale, and celery smoothies seem to eliminate the chocolate craving for me. For me, I'm not a dietitian, I'm not a nutritionist, but work for me. So get the processed crap out of your diet, get more nutrition into your diet, and, you know, the combination worked a miracle. For me, it works miracles for a lot of people. and it should work a miracle for you.
I love that, Glenn. That's such a fantastic way to end the podcast. And I just want to thank you so much for the work that you do, for your time here, the amount of value you've given me and everybody listening, because there is just tools amongst tools that you've mentioned here between where to identify where your overeating is coming from, where your binge eating, between the triggers, between the practical things that you can apply, the techniques to hijack that reptilian brain, avoiding the processed foods and nourishing your body, and the mindset that comes alongside that. So thank you so much for all of that. Glenn, can you link everybody or tell everybody where is the best place for them to connect with you? Where can they pick up the book or anywhere else you want to send them? Please do that now.
At neverbingeagain.com, if you click the big red button and sign up for the reader bonuses, you'll get three things. You get a free copy of the book in Kindle, Nook, or PDF format. We do have paperback and Audible, but there's a charge for that. But it's free for Kindle, Nook, or PDF. You'll get a set of recorded full-length coaching sessions, because I know this sounds really weird, but I promise you it's a very compassionate, life-giving process when you actually hear it in action, and I want you to hear that. And you'll get a free set of food plan starter templates, so regardless of whether you're trying to eat, you know, keto or high carb or low carb or point counting or calorie counting or macrobiotic, whatever you're trying to do, we'll give you some examples of food plans that you can adjust for your own needs. So neverbingeagain.com, click the big red button. We also have coaching programs and coach training programs, and you know, we have something that's more like a high-end rehab if you really need that. We only do one or two of those a month, but neverbingeagain.com, click the big red button, you'll find everything.
Amazing. And for everybody listening, I will link those in the show notes for today's episode on BrianKeenFitness.com and on the description for the iTunes, for Overcast, Podbean, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. Glenn, thank you so much again.
Thank you for having me.
There you have it, Glenn Livingston on food addiction, overeating, and how to never binge again. Hopefully you got a lot of new tools and resources that may be applicable to you moving forward. One of the things I try and do with this podcast is bring on lots of different experts in different diets, different nutritional protocols, or in the case of Glenn, a psychologist who will offer new approaches to potentially help with your binge eating. So using tools as you need them, take the things from today's episodes that are the most applicable for you, the things that jumped out the most at you, and apply them and see if they're going to be a good fit to helping you deal with either your overeating, your stress eating, or your binge eating. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode. As always, if you did, be sure to let me know on Instagram. And if you want to get my top three takeaways, be sure to head over to BrianKeenFitness.com and subscribe to my weekly newsletter. Every Thursday at lunchtime, I send out my newsletter, which will have my top three takeaways from that week's podcast. So in this week's episode, I will be thinking about and writing up what I got and my top takeaways from today's episode with Glenn Livingston, PhD, on food addiction, overeating, and how to never binge again. So head over to BrianKeenFitness.com. On the homepage, pop in your email and you will subscribe to my weekly newsletter that goes out every single Thursday. That's all from this week's episode. Catch you all next Monday.